we're basically got two things to go through today. I'm glad we're watching people here. Nice. We're going to first half talking about physiology, experimental physiology more specifically, and then the second half talking about phrenology, in particular how these two disciplines, somewhat contemporaneous, not exactly, but actually dealing with a similar set of variables and forms, sort of significant changes in 19th century history of medicine. What I'm going to pass out to you right now, thank you, is two handouts of lecture notes for today. It's supposed to be much easier for those who are here, and then also for those who aren't here because of the holiday tomorrow. So the job is to sort of follow along with the lecture notes, and sort of this will galvanize some of the stuff from the reading, and then we'll occasionally refer to some of the primary texts. I want to start with the first handout, which is experimental physiology for the talk, where I want to sort of walk through who the significant figures are and significant stakes about thinking about physiology and experimental method as a distinct discipline in 19th century medicine. This will help us segue then into talking about phrenology as sort of an evidentiary sort of like specialty that deals with some of these same dimensions and some of these same tensions. So if you pull up the handout on experimental physiology, and then maybe set off to the side, if you've got it with you, the excerpt that I provided for you from Claude Bernard's An Introduction to the Study of Experimental Medicine. What I want to do is walk through this handout, which provides a kind of chronology of the significant features and the significant stakes of physiology as a distinct discipline, and then occasionally gesture towards Claude Bernard's seminal text. So, looking at the top of the handout that I provided for you, first of all, physiology is a distinct field for the first time in the 19th century. Now, when we talk about physiology, what we're talking about is usually the study of living systems, is how we define it, which is to say cellular, tissue, organ, species, human, animal, plant, botany, all of these different things sort of come together into this category of physiology. Now, why that's significant is that there really is no specialized field of biology, as we call it at this time. In fact, natural sciences is really the term that we're thinking about really having the most currency in the 17th and 18th, and is now starting to be in the 19th century. To that end, the birth of physiology makes possible ultimately the creation of this field of biology, but also this notion of specialization that really was not possible beforehand, which is significant because it allows not just this experimental method to come in, but it allows the study of natural sciences, as we understand them, life sciences, if you will, to be a part of the scientific method in a new way. And this is what physiology makes possible. So the questions then become, what are the rules of health? Physiology becomes important then because it's about trying to understand how the life sciences and how medicine and how scientific method might actually be in the same constellation or the same sphere of disciplines. I have listed here a pre-1800 meeting of physiology, one would have to see Boerhaave. And to that end, it's about trying to think about a difference without the lexicon of physiology, what those words would be. To that end, the point of this question we have here below, can you have a history of biology before the 19th century? Now, part of the reason you can't have a history of biology before the 19th century is the term didn't exist. So, just a level of lexicon. Without the word biology, it's sort of hard to say whether that biology existed. But secondly, it's also difficult because this idea that there could be this large umbrella global understanding of the life sciences and of living systems would have been not possible really until the 19th century. Natural history, and thus all the natural history museums we have throughout the world now, really are a testament towards trying to think about that kind of knowledge, but not really unifying under a simple or a single scientific method. And this is what physiology makes possible. I listed here just two sort of examples for us. The question of the body as the machine and the mind as the soul we've talked about before. These were tensions that made it difficult to think about biology as a distinct field before the 19th century. Or as I said here, there is no ontology of living things, no separate discipline, which is significant then. The idea that there's a method for how to do medicine or how to do living systems or how to do biology would have been a very 19th century finding. And it really is the thing that hovers over who are basically going to be the major figures that I want to walk through with you for about the next 20 minutes. I can get you to make or take note of this little timeline. Here are the individuals we're going to walk through today, who I think of as sort of like, and they kind of are referred to as the forefathers, so to speak, in physiology. But we've talked about a couple before, and I want to walk through. We're going to talk about Bichat first. And if you remember talking about Bichat last week when we were talking about Paris medicine and the creation of histology and distinct fields of physiology, Bichat is considered the grandfather. We're going to move on to talking about a German scientist named Müller, Johannes Peter Müller, and then we're going to sort of move to who are sort of like the three big daddies in terms of thinking about this field of physiology, and they are Cuvier, Magendie, and ultimately be right for today, Claude Bernard. To that end, we can see there's a very French-heavy sort of like emphasis here, Mueller, though, being the German exception to this model. But what I want to talk about here is that what Paris Medicine were talking about, and this French notion of us understanding an organization of science and medicine that made possible a reorganization of medicine, also galvanized all these particular scientists toward this particular discipline, but how they could take a scientific method with living systems and wed it to this new kind of medicine and a particular kind of physiological sort of practice. So to that end, looking at this handout that we have here, the space between this notion of mechanics and metaphysics is ultimately where biology and by extension physiology sort of appears. So we talked about that tension between trying to think about a metaphysics or a mechanics of a body or a soul that was tensioning in medicine. Well, ironically, biology comes in as that place in between, as a discipline that tries to speak to both of these matters. Cell theory is essential to biology, I've listed here, fundamental unit to life, which determines life form from other studies. To that degree, then, Bichat's question of histology, his study of thinking about the tissue at the cellular level of anatomies, really makes possible what's going to kickstart this series of scientists. Now, I'm going to return to these bottom three here, the significant French physiologists that really form the core of this discipline. But to be truthfully, the Institute of Physiology and the discipline of physiology really has its roots in Mueller that we see up here, this German anatomist, German physiologist. He was also a specialist in fish studies, ichthyology, isn't that what they call it? Ichthyology, something like that, right? So his specialty was to think about the categorization and classification of anatomy of fish and other animals, but in the service of thinking about the life sciences and the physiology. In fact, it's Mueller's creation of a particular kind of taxonomy and discipline that makes possible this particular field, if you will. Turn the page, because what I really want to focus on then is what Bernard brings to this discipline of physiology. So looking on the top of the page, and what I had you read from was a couple of excerpts from the introduction to the study of experimental medicine. There's a couple of things to take very significantly here from this. The first is the nature of that text. So I've listed here that the text was popular, widely translated, easy to read as a text, despite the fact that it's an historical document or it's an older text. If you notice from the small example that I gave you, not from the introduction, but from part three, the text is at once experimental heavy, but very evidentiary. So very sort of like, for example, I did this one experiment using carbon monoxide and determined blah, blah, blah. And another experiment, the rabbit one, right?
Yes, the urine.
Yes, urine, yeah, exactly. So there's this way in which he wants to be very anecdotal in terms of describing what his particular theory is. That signifies the experimental method, but it also signifies a kind of attempt to want to make the medicine and the science also germane, applicable, relatable to a readership, if you will. To that end, there seems to be something technical and lofty about the physiological and experimental method and that it wants to live up to the scientific standard, but there's also something like just the facts, ma'am, if you will, about how it wants to approach that particular form of study. And this really is a sort of half of Paris medicine meets a new kind of scientific method in the 19th century that's very significant. So Bernard's text has those particular feels to it, but also because of the fact that it bears with it a kind of lineage to these other scientists beforehand. So let's look at the first one who's on here, where it says Cuvier. George Cuvier is his full name. Cuvier dates are 1769 to 1832. In fact, I can give you our other ones. 1871 to 1882, and Mueller is 1801 to 1858. So Cuvier is actually like a, we would call a, not even such a natural historian, but a naturist, if you will. A large part of his work was to taxonomize and to categorize a lot of the wildlife and a lot of the different animal kingdoms and species, if you will. To that end, his concern is with French medicine and French studies, but actually with a kind of way of thinking about how biology, sciences, and animal studies actually inform medicine in a significant way. Now, why this is significant is if we saw resistance, for example, in the past, towards animal experimentation, toward vivisection, toward trying to see if there is a propensity where human anatomy is like animal anatomy. If we saw that tension in thinking about the Cartesian notion of mind-body dualism had a lot to do with about, is the body just like every other animal in the species, in the kingdom, or is it very different in a human being? Well, Cuvier's work really makes possible what is ultimately the cornerstone of this particular kind of physiology, which is to say that animal experimentation and experimentations of all kinds are the cornerstone of not just science and biology and living systems, but medicine itself too. So what was a tension before in terms of thinking about, can we learn anything from the anatomy of other animals? Can we collate anatomy in a larger cross-species sort of way that challenged human studies and human anatomy studies and human medicine studies? Now it's actually become kind of a cornerstone with these particular figures. And the reason being that the experimental method is not an added benefit to understanding medical science, but it's actually the central quality that needs to be there. Méjean-Dee in particular is very famous because of the fact that his work really was in two parts. He did a lot of work on looking at human anatomy and on human histology, and did a lot of work really just on the history of animals, if you will, trying to taxonomize and categorize these species. And for him, those were not two different jobs or tasks or agendas. In fact, for him, they were very comparable and similar. I hope you'll see that we're already starting to gesture towards what we're going to get to with phrenology that come in the 19th century with an obsession to map, to localize, to understand in terms of the anatomy whether there is no difference between the marking and the mapping of anatomy and its actual scientific and medical basis. So to that degree, anatomy isn't just an added tool, it's actually the fundamental thing that helps us understand what science is and what medicine is particularly. Looking at Méjean-Dee then, I just wanted to point to a couple of facts for him here. Let me see, put his dates as well up. Méjean-Dee was a student of Cuvier and was very learned in Bichat, which is to say that his greatest skill was the fact that he was almost completely fluent in talking about the skills of Bichat. In fact, you probably have noticed this even looking in Claude Bernard's, that there's a kind of fluency with which to talk about Bichat or Cuvier as really indicative of one's particular loyalty towards this particular kind of physiological enterprise. So Méjean-Dee's was a student of Cuvier, learned in Bichat, especially in anatomy, but he actually, like Cuvier, could not get a job in Paris medical schools. The reason being that while Paris medicine made possible this notion of clinical practice and the clinic being so important, what Méjean-Dee, what Cuvier, and even what Bichat was gesturing towards, that the clinic is important. If the birth of the clinic is a thing that Foucault wants to say is so significant, there are also these men working this time that are saying it is not just the clinic, but may what actually trump the clinic is the laboratory, if you will, this idea that experimental method can be significant. Going so far as to say, yes, the clinic is important to us, but only insofar as we treat the clinic as a laboratory, if you will. This idea that we're learning there, not just from watching, but in some way from experimenting, to putting forward an hypothesis, to testing it, to see what the result that comes back from our experiences in the clinic. To that degree, what we're seeing here is not a refutation, if you will, of the clinic, or of Paris medicine, or of medicine before it, but almost an evolution. So that what we're going to find then is this movement away from the medical marketplace, from bedside medicine, towards a hospital, clinical medicine, but also advancing into this notion of a laboratory kind of medicine. So you'll notice that space and place becomes important, but those spaces and places indicating a particular kind of loyalty to a particular kind of methodology. Méjean-Dee, Bernard, Cuvier, Bichat, these are figures that made possible the birth of the clinic as the space for medicine, but also were pushing to move beyond the clinic to the laboratory, if for no other reason also, but that the 19th century was a century of incredible rapid development in the central place of the laboratory and all of science, and the desire for medicine to see itself as part of science. I suppose that's the important thing to note here also as well, that if we had seen in the past medicine sometimes as a discipline that replicated or reminded us of scientific method or scientific progress, we know that we have seen in centuries prior a tension where science was in one place and medicine was in another, where the empirical method was in one place in science, but in medicine and physiology, it started to fall, to lag, going a lot to tradition. Well, the 19th century, right after Paris medicine, is an attempt to really try to catch up, if you will. This loyalty towards physiology and experimental physiology is an attempt to not just bring medicine up to par with science, but to bring medicine into the fold of science, if you will. And a way to do that is to acknowledge the clinic, but to see the clinic as a scientific space, not just a therapeutic space to some degree. Does that make sense? Okay. So why couldn't he get a job?
Because he wanted to use it as a lab and they didn't.
Well, he wanted to use it for training and he wanted to use it for advancement, but also to some degree what he was doing was taking the Paris medicine model and saying it needs to be improved in a period that was only about a decade or two old. So to that degree, what seemed to be revolutionary in the creation of the clinic as a space of tutelage in medical school education, he was trying to make this space also experimentation. And to that degree, it felt like, that's why I said I don't think it is a refutation of Paris medicine, but it felt like one to the people that were there. Yeah.
Was it just people who were inside of the profession of medicine who saw it not as in the fold of science, or was it like the general layman who believed that as well?
There was a little lag, so a lot of it were laypersons who would not want to see their own life, livelihood being something else but just another part of experimental or scientific medicine. So there would have been a practical reason. There's another reason also too why Desjardins was not allowed to go to into French medical schools, and that's because the experimental method was so important to him, and animal experimentation was so important. I had it listed here at the bottom, knowledge from animal experimentation. But he actually was, what made possible in this century too, a huge person involved in vivisection. So he was sort of doing experiments on animals, living animals, left and right, in ways that even people who supported vivisection at the time were a bit sort of appalled. Who did what to that animal? You know, that kind of thing. But for him, it was the cornerstone, not just of understanding the anatomy of that particular animal, but actually in the advancement of medicine itself, too. In many ways, Desjardins, I think of as the person that really gave birth to this idea of animal experimentation and maybe even animal testing as a way with which to understand the efficacy of certain kinds of therapeutic treatments on humans. Which is to say, he can be the greatest villain for certain animal rights activists, but he can also be sort of the greatest hero for a person who made the leap that to realize how can we use certain kinds of medicinal properties on animals to determine what their negative effects might be on humans? Yeah.
Can I ask a very, very basic question?
Sure.
It's pretty essential when people are growing up that they learn by doing certain things, certain things happen, right?
And yeah.
Kids learn how to reach and get a toy and all that kind of stuff. How is it that it took so long, as you're describing, to approach medicine in this way, that in a systematic way? I mean, even the docs must have, in the early times, said this works, this doesn't work, this works most of the time. I don't understand why it took so long.
I'll put it to you this way. It's not that there was no use of knowledge based on experience or empirical or sensorial sort of or trial and error. It would have been a part of medicine first. How could it not be? Every profession works that way. You know, you're only going to, you know, if you're going to find something isn't efficacious towards healing persons and it works, fails 13 times, then maybe you're going to want to change. So experience does play a part. The hard part was valuing that experience. Can it trump the knowledge that is handed down to you? Is it as valuable as the age-old wisdom that is the cornerstone of not just your profession, but your very cosmological worldview? That's the least
difficult. There really was that tension? Like, an individual would really be stuck with that, and I have this old wisdom, and it would trump what you saw?
We could. Yeah. So, and not to say that the old wisdom is bad, let's not forget that we're not handing down sort of like totally stupid stuff, because that old wisdom itself is based on experience and experiment on an empirical sort of method to some degree. So that hand, the hard part is what I'm learning in the present day, what I'm experiencing with you as an individual, a single person, does that value more than the whole breadth of knowledge that I have? And I'll give you an example. It was very hard to think about at that time that there could be an assessment of disease prior to Paris medicine with which I could use my collective experiences with all of you, if you were all my patients, and how you had dealt with symptoms, and to call all of that knowledge together to determine a single kind of therapeutic avenue. It just wasn't in the worldview in a very significant way. What was instead significant was I have to treat you as you. And yes, I've experienced this with Brenda and Stephen, and it sort of worked, but I still have to stick to you. So tell me about you, let me check out you, let me think on my readings and my learnings, and let me see how those inform how I think about you. And yes, let me think about Steve and Brenda too, but Steve and Brenda experience don't trump everything else, you know? Instead, I really need to focus on you as an individual. And it's that lack of seeing a kind of uniformity, a kind of like consensus across bodies, across anatomies, across physiologies, which is the thing that's hard for us to wrap our heads around, but it really is a significant sort of cornerstone. To that, an experience, trial and error, absolutely informs how a doctor would do things. You know, a doctor, whether it's a treatment that, or a potion that might have worked or might not have worked with one individual, sure, that informs to some degree what the physicians were doing, or whether it would change their bedside manner or the way they talk to patients, absolutely. But the significance, the fundamental value of the learning, of the scholarship, and of the cosmologically, medically informed knowledge that would have determined how I treated each person differently and distinctly. That's a worldview that's hard to get away from, hard to get around. Yeah, but you're totally right that, like, in life, don't we all learn, you know, trip over the crack 9 times, I think the 10th time I'm gonna step over it, so that would have been involved, but it's not to the point where it does away with the entire methodology. Any other questions? But that's why these scientists are significant then too, because what they're trying to do here then is show that with the primacy of the experimental method and the primacy of this kind of animal experimentation, seeing the clinic as a laboratory, what they're doing actually is saying that thing where Paris Medicine was trying to say, let's now, put it to this way. Your question was, didn't they do any kind of experience, any kind of trial and error to determine the knowledge? Yes, they did do a bit. But damn, all that learning and cosmology meant so much more. Paris Medicine tried to do this. It tried to say, what you learn today is important, what you experience, how you understand the clinic is important, but you still need that old learning too. What these scientists are moving towards and why they might be kind of a Paris Medical School is, this is bullshit. All you can know is the experimental method you do, what you experience and what you've seen in it, maybe a little logic, maybe a little math and statistics to help you figure out, not necessarily, it doesn't have to be, but what you experience in that experiment is the cornerstone of knowledge, and beyond that, it's not, that isn't, anything beyond that is not knowledge. That's just hearsay, or that's just rumor, if you will. So the experimental method then absolutely does away with all the rest of that. Yeah?
While you're giving an explanation, I was thinking, I think that tension still exists even today, because, for instance, in epidemiology, where we look at large groups of people, and we do organized observational experiments, if you will, natural history experiments, or natural experiments, as we call them, one of the first ways that you poke holes an individual clinical observation and reports is to say, well, whatever one or two or even three doctors observe doesn't make for a new truth. That's generally the starting position. Now, sometimes that's accurate, sometimes that's not accurate. Mm-hmm. But that tension still exists between individual clinical experience and group structured observation.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because we're talking about a whole set of tools that a clinician can use, did use, still uses. And so it's not a question that no one didn't use experience, or that experimental method was invented in this particular century, what have you. It's a question of loyalties and degrees, and to how much do you want to use that tool, and how much do you want to chuck a couple of them out of the toolbox entirely. This century becomes significant in the beginning of it, where Paris Medicine started, not just because of the fact that it wants to upend what is finally going to be seen as significant in the central training and dissemination of medical and clinical care, but the way that it actually wants to, over the course of that century, determine your actual allegiance or not to certain schools of thought and of clinical practice, whether it's the experience you have with the patient, the experiment that you do in determining knowledge, the books that you've read, the clinic where you want to do space, the laboratory, why you want it to happen. This century is a very significant one because great advancement is happening and been a long time coming, as we've seen. Centuries have been waiting for this. And yet, it's one where there's a great deal of tension over whose team are you on, whose side are you on, what kind of scientist and what kind of clinician do you see yourself? Yeah.
So there wasn't, what you're saying, you're not saying there was ever an evening. I thought that's where you were going, because it was like the primacy of the ancient stuff and then this new stuff, and then it flipped. It never evened itself out, like in the mind of these
persons?
Yeah.
I think what we're going to see is a lessening of certainly classical medical texts that's happening after Paris Medicine. But then what constitutes the canonical is a new definition, right? This is a difficult, if the canonical was one of the constants that we saw for centuries in terms of what was the cornerstone of traditional medicine, once we're learning less and less what Galen and Hippocrates are saying on a daily, practical sort of level, then what is the canonical? It's a reason also someone like Majon, he would get kicked out of a French medical school. Because the new canonical is supposed to be Paris Medicine. How dare you say that it's not quite adequate enough to some degree? Yeah.
So I see like a third side beyond, you know, just trying to, I think it's very positivism, right? This idea that the a posteriori, the empirical is what forms our base of knowledge. But then Kant, around the same time, he was like early 1800s, I think, he rejected this idea of a posteriori categorically and said it's all about a priori knowledge, and anything else that's not a priori knowledge in science is crap, right? And that's like a complete rejection of what we're seeing in experimental physiology.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if around this time there was anyone like Team Kant.
Oh, sure. Plenty of people are team. Well, Kant is also our ultimate half-brain-will-travel kind of guy. You know what I mean? So he would absolutely think that a posteriori wouldn't have to be the cornerstone for how you learn about knowledge. But there would be a problem. The hard part is you're going to find fewer and fewer of those people in medicine than you used to. And you're certainly going to find fewer and fewer of them in science. Such that the experimental method doesn't become the fad that it may have been the last century and a half, but it becomes the prerequisite to consider yourself. That's why I look at Bernard and Mejanti and Cuvier doing this. They're saying, we're not medical men, we're medical scientists, is what we are. And that's why a posteriori becomes so important to them. Now, if you're going to find somebody who'd be fine with just a priori knowledge, that sort of thing, it'd be somebody who probably would not want to call themselves a medical scientist. And really, it's that notion of wanting to call oneself a medical scientist that I think is this 19th century coinage of this new invention. So Kant's got plenty of friends, I think, in the medical realm. But whether they're calling themselves medical scientists, certainly medical experimental scientists, probably not so, I would say.
And were they looked on as sort of relics, like condescension?
No, because we're talking about a period here of transition, which is to say that while Paris medicine seemed to happen quickly, that notion of being considered antiquated would have been debatable in the first half of the 19th century in particular. And on the one hand, it made possible a lot of great advancements. On the other hand, it also made possible for those who were wanting an experimental and an anatomical sort of science, the rushed acceptance of a discipline like phrenology that we'll see in the second half of this class, such that if it looks like science and it smells like science, it must be great, even though we know that phrenology was not scrutinized perhaps to the degree that it probably should have been when it first came out. So to that end, one could find inadequacies or villains perhaps on either campus or either sides of the debate. Yeah.
Quick question on terms. The middle of the 19th century, in the arts, the Romantic era, what do you call it? What do you call this in terms of medical history? Is there a, Is a way of designating it?
A couple ways. I mean, some people call it post-Paris medicine. It's sometimes called the era of experimental medicine. Sometimes it's called the era of positivism as well, too. It depends on what country we're talking about as well, too. So positivism, we're going to talk about just a second, it's at the bottom of the sheet. But looking at American medicine in particular, German medicine, I think we see a lot of positive, some degree French also, too. But the exact term for this ministry, I don't know. It's hard because it's a period of such flux and transition, of so many changes and very few continuities, that it's hard, I think, to unify under a single sort of
label. It doesn't seem to have a label in the way the Enlightenment has a label, or Paris medicine has a label, and that sort of struck me in terms of reading this.
Yeah, I think you're apt to hear literally called 19th century medicine.
Right, okay.
Yeah, for all of its many permutations. Let's look real quick at a couple more things here about Mejanti and Bernard, so I'm anxious to have us look just a little bit of Bernard's text. So thinking about Mejanti, he likewise was a natural historian. A priori knowledge had no value for him whatsoever, who led to Claude Bernard, who was an assistant to Mejanti. So we have this sort of like lineage, if you will, where Bichat informs the work of Cuvier, Cuvier then teaches Mejanti, and Mejanti is an assistant to Claude Bernard. Claude Bernard says here, theorized the practices of Mejanti. His ultimate thing is that with each man who's passing on the succession over the course, as we see here, of basically about a decade or so apart in their work, different half generation, an upping of the stakes of the value of this experimental method. To that end, for Bernard, there is no physiological knowledge without animal experimentation specifically and without scientific experimentation more generally. He is one of the people who definitely took the technologies on drug use and saw how they affect animal systems, absolutely determines how they can affect human systems. So what Mejanti theorized, what was the cornerstone of, I told you, Mejanti basically did two things. I work on anatomy and thinking about physiology and animals, zoology, basically. And for him, they were comparable practices because for him to taxonomize and to categorize those two disciplines actually could have some overlap. Bernard said, let's put that shit in action, and did it with his experiments in a way that would have made possible the kind of animal experimentation and drug testing that would never have been used before, would have been considered offensive beforehand. And for Bernard, it was efficacious. If it's efficacious, therefore it's functionally invaluable. He also in here studied, for example, one of his major studies, the liver studies I provided here, on the production of glucose. To that end, he was actually did a lot of that experimentation and knowledge from using his work on animal experiments. His introduction to the study of experimental medicine, which we're going to look at in a second here, is a rhetorical text, and to that end, it's providing, in some ways, a kind of conversation with its reader, but also a kind of how-to guide in terms of what the value of and the application of your particular knowledge is. Positivism is the motivation for this. Positivism coming from Auguste Comte, a French theorist, a kind of utopian socialist, if you will. He's a contemporary, C-O-M-T-E, if you can read that, August. Contemporary of Marx, and had a lot to do with thinking about what are the ultimate values and forms of knowledge, what are the ultimate sort of ways with which we can prioritize the present and the value of the knowledge and experiences and persons in the present, not at the expense of having to be loyal or be held to ideas, systems, hierarchies, privileges of the past. So in a socialist economical model, this was how can we serve the best good for all men in the present without having to be loyal towards a hierarchy of class, or so to speak. And in terms of science and knowledge, it was the similar tension of how can we value and prioritize the knowledge that we learn in the here and now, not having to be beholden to knowledge that's passed on to us before. To that end, what is a cornerstone of political and economic rhetoric at the time in terms of socialist philosophy is actually informing science as well, medicine specifically, because to learn in the present and to give value to those in the present and the knowledge that we have in the present is actually something of revolutionary, even Marx's sort of attitude. To that end, this is the positivism philosophy of sensory experience above all else informs us, logic and math to a lesser degree, and beyond that, there is no knowledge or anything else. The end. Turn the page, and I want to just go through a couple more facts, and this is a good sort of rundown. For Bernard, we have here, for Bernard, then, the individual inquirer confronts nature using reason, but the word that's significant there is confronts. And to that degree, what it is to say that when we confront, we test, we challenge nature, and that's how we learn from it. We don't just stare nature in the face and try to logically, reasonably sort of think about what nature could mean, but we actually challenge, we actually confront the natural, the living systems, the biology, and the medicine as well. The introduction to the experimental medicine, which we're going to look at in a second here, is basically has three main features, which I've listed here. Physiology as a science, and therefore, as all science, reason is done in the same way. This is done through trial and error, experimentation, testing of hypotheses. Two, science is actually, physiology is also different, though, than most science in the fact that it deals with a particular discipline, and a discipline that deals with human anatomy. To that sense, it's a distinct kind of field that also mirrors and models itself on science. And to that end, the third feature of this text, and this is a very significant one, is that Bernard regularly uses his own work to explain any of his ideas in this text, which sounds like a standard feature, but actually it's very significant. To that end, what we're seeing is the ultimate reference point to prove one's ideas is one's own work, one's own experiments, and to lay those particular out. This is absolutely significant and absolutely novel in the 19th century for medical science that's happening at this time. We would see this tons in classical medical literature that persons would point to their own experiments and conclusions, but that long history of traditional learning in Western medicine really isn't just that I read a lot, but that the ultimate citation and source I can provide of affirmation, confirmation for my work textually and historically is an antecedent. This is suggesting, and as Bernard's text points out, the ultimate citation I can give is what I did yesterday in my laboratory, or what I saw in the clinic yesterday. So that's its third main feature. To that end, Bernard has an empiricist account of his relationship between science and learning, and this is kind of interesting to note. His point is always to provide a hypothesis and counter-hypothesis in each of his writings. To that end, one needs to test both to determine a causal explanation of the subject that is at hand, which is also significant. That we're seeing at this time, then, an appreciation and a valuing of the idea that to explain one's physiological and medical opinion is to entertain its objection, its counterpart, and to dismantle it, if you will, to some degree. So there's actually a kind of advancement then, not just in experimental method, but maybe in rhetoric as well, and argumentation in medicine at this particular time. Any other questions right now? Okay, so let me just run through these couple of facts that are right here listed on the last part of the page. Science is progressive and cumulative, and the word cumulative being a significant advancement here. Fundamentally, all sciences reason in the same way. I put off the side here. Bichat says physiology is done a different way because there are exceptions in physiology. And so that Bernard and Bichat want to make physiology a science, but in different ways, which is what I've listed here. The former, aligning physiology with other sciences, and the latter, differentiating it to say the distinct science. To that end, what's significant here is not how close or how exact the synonym is made between science and medicine, but that trying to determine what is that exact relationship is now the fundamental question in how to do medicine in the 19th century, with experimental method, with standards, with thinking how important logic and reason is in medicine and the way that it's important in science. Trying to understand the relationship between medicine and science is the way to make medicine better, not trying to understand the relationship between medicine today and medicine in the past, which might be a more applicable way of putting what Paris medicine sort of tried to work out. To that end, how much medicine looks like science is the way that we can actually prove that it's most efficacious and that it's most respectable. Of course, we will come to find that this has many negative effects as well in terms of delivery of healthcare in the 19th century, but it is showing there's a different kind of striving at the level of professional standard in the 19th century, and it's made possible by this very physiological understanding of experimental medicine. Organisms have a determined internal environment. It's one thing that's significant here. Medicine should be based on this sort of physiological argument. Diseases are the same as what happens in the laboratory, basically, is what's sort of being argued at this particular time. You'll notice again, as I said before, that looking ahead to phrenology, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes, there's this attempt to want to cartographically sort of understand how anatomy, how disease, and how physiology can be understood in a way that really provides for them a sort of a scientific but also a very technical sort of like mapping. And to that degree, what we're seeing then is an attempt to almost render in a kind of statistical but also quantifiable way medicine in a way that hasn't been done prior to this particular century. That having to do with the idea that the experiment and that science absolutely are fundamental. Or as it says here, experimental physiology is the basis of medicine. Without it, medicine is not scientific. And that's a big difference, big question, a big difference. So what constitutes medicine is different than how is medicine scientific or not. And that's where there's been a slight change here with the rise of physiology. All right, let's take a look at Bernard's text. I just want to point to a couple of examples. Then I mostly want to talk about phrenology and its wonderful, crazy agglomeration of ideas and pictures and things. Turn to page 2 in here. I just want to direct you towards a couple of passages. You hear a little bit of the prose from Bernard's mail. And he says, this is in the middle of page 2. But scientific medicine, like the other sciences, can be established only by experimental means, i.e., by direct and rigorous application of reasoning to the facts furnished us by observation and experiment. Considered in itself, the experimental method is nothing but reasoning by whose help we methodically submit our ideas to experience, the experience of facts. Reasoning is always the same, whether in the sciences that study living beings or in those concerned with inorganic bodies. But each kind of science presents different phenomena and complexities and difficulties of investigation, peculiarly its own. As we shall later see, this makes the principles of experimentation incomparably harder to apply to medicine, and the phenomena of living bodies and to physics, and the phenomena of inorganic bodies. So we can see here, I think, a bit the stakes that's being talked about, not just in the conversation that's being made possible by him between what anatomy, what physiology, what medicine might have to say to other forms of scientific knowledge and learning, but also the way in which there's a really kind of a change in worldview, not just methodology that's being applied here. To that end, how significant reasoning works in medicine, and in particular, how significant experimentation is going to be in the discovery of, or the revealing, if you will, of medical knowledge, is really a huge game change. To that degree, some of the practices haven't changed significantly. It's almost like the mission statement has changed in medicine at this particular time. Or as it says here on the top of page 3, the first full paragraph, to be worthy of the name, an experimenter must be at once theorist and practitioner. While he must completely master the art of establishing experimental facts, which are the materials of science, he must also clearly understand the scientific principles which guide his reasoning through the varied experimental study of natural phenomena. We cannot separate these two things, head and hand. An able hand, without a head to direct it, is a blind tool. The head is powerless without its executive hand. Now think about what we talked about last week with the surgeon and the physician and thinking what knowledge to prioritize. And this is a period where what Paris medicine was trying to do was level both and value both. Well, Bernard is saying that too, but in the service of a scientific method and a particular kind of methodology that isn't about evening the playing field from two professions that had a bad hierarchy from medicine before. Instead, it's you need both, not because you need to make the surgeon and the physician equal or because you need to work out problems in the profession in the past, but because this is what science demands and necessitates. What I want to do is reread this paragraph, and what I'd like you to do at the top is when it says the word experimenter in the first line, right off the side the word clinician, because for Bernard, those terms can be interchangeable. For him, if to be a clinician is to be a medical scientist, and if to be a medical scientist is to be an experimenter, then to be a clinician is to be an experimenter. And to that degree, this is a statement, a mantra, if you will, for what he thinks a doctor has to be at this time. So I'm going to read it again and think about it not as experimenter, but doctor. To be worthy of the name, a doctor must be at once theorist and practitioner. While he must completely master the art of establishing experimental facts, which are the materials of science, he must also clearly understand the scientific principles which guide his reasoning through the varied experimental study of natural phenomena. We cannot separate these two things, head and hand. An able hand without a head to direct it is a blind tool. The head is powerless without its executive hand. What's so savvy about this then is that if there's a shift in the middle of the 19th century away from just this tension that was happening that Paris medicine rectified, head, hand, physician, surgeon, clinic, books, empiricism, learning, those things trying to be equated, those things trying to all be brought to the fold. What Bernard does is take the rudiments and takes the variables of that same debate, but moves it onto another plane entirely, a plane that takes us towards scientific method and experimentation, such that one is still working in the same field of improvement that Paris medicine made possible, being concerned with these very variables, but in the service of a different and loftier goal. Make yourself a scientist. Make yourself an experimenter. And he goes so far, this is why of all the cats we got up here on the board, Bernard is the most. Bernard would then say, anything short of that, and you probably shouldn't even call yourself a doctor or a clinician, if you will. That's how significant the experimental method is to him. Any questions? All right, if I have given that a chance yet, take a look at some of the examples he provides in here, because they are quite revealing and illuminating, if you will, in the examples. And take a look at, as well, the last two paragraphs I provided for you, excised here, page 161 to 162. He takes the experiment that he did working with carbon dioxide and oxygen in the blood, and then uses that in the service of like why it's significant to have a medical theory or hypothesis, and without those basic building blocks of the scientific method as we know them, one isn't actually doing medical science or physiology, as he would call it. In fact, it's almost as though physiology becomes not just the study of this discipline, it almost becomes a brand. That one isn't doing the right kind of medicine, if you will, a physiology brand kind of medicine, unless it has the experimental method involved. The last two paragraphs that I've heard of you almost say exactly that much in a very explicit sort of way. Any questions before we move on to phrenology? We're going to find there's a lot of the same variables at stake here in phrenology. It's just a much more specific example and a much more loaded one on a very specific context. All right, pull up the handout in phrenology. Did everybody get one? Yes. How many of you have heard of phrenology before? Either because you got a Roots album or something like that, right? Okay. Or because like you always see that, like sometimes if you go to like the LL Bean catalog, they'll be in the corner like a little bust of the phrenology head is supposed to look sort of quaint. You know what I mean? Like yeah. So I think even if we haven't studied phrenology, we've seen that head with the different demarcations as an almost kind of like overheard thing in our cultural conversation. You know, something like put that head with all those bumps on the floor. What I want to do is walk you through, again, some of the major figures that we have in phrenology, and then I want to gesture us towards some of the examples that I provided for us here in this text for today. Turning to the handout that I gave, though, about phrenology, I want to start by going through about the first page of this to just give you a sense about who we're talking about and who our significant players are. If this was our talk on physiology over here, I'm going to leave it up. Then our phrenology is pretty much going to go in this direction, which is Gaul, Spurzheim, the Combe and Fowler brothers, and then this new section that we're going to talk about called New Phrenology, which will ultimately take us to 20th century notions of brain localization theory. Now, when we talk about phrenology, we are absolutely talking about this discipline of how to demarcate the brain, how to feel the bumps on your head, how to read the cranium, how to think about the fact that there could be different faculties. And sometimes it seems like a pseudo-personality test, and sometimes it seems like a very specific way of identifying and isolating key parts of brain functioning. The important thing to know about phrenology, for us in a very general sense, is that the movement towards understanding histology, towards understanding physiology in a very precise way, and of using a kind of scientific method that we talked about of experimentation and testing, phrenology really galvanizes all of these ideas at the level of how do we think about that in terms of the brain? And in particular, how do we think about that in terms of the notion of brain localization theory? It's not written down on your handout, write that at the top. It says here the functional topography of the brain is what that is, the functional mapping of the brain. But really what we're talking about here is brain localization theory. This idea that the brain isn't just a holistic sort of organ, but the fact that there are specialized functions and parts to it, and it's different sort of parts of the brain itself. To that end, it's treating the nuance of the brain, not just the totality of the brain. It's about thinking of the anatomy of a particular organ, this primary organ, because now we're seeing this organ as being the seat, the house of the mind and the soul, thinking and reason. And to that end, thinking that there actually is a very precise and strategic way that this mind is organized. Therefore, inspired very much by advancements, technologies, beliefs in a kind of specific anatomy, if you will. But also, therefore, thinking with a kind of ambitiousness towards brain localization theory without any sort of prior precursors to it. And to that end, that's why we see a drastic overcompensation for trying to map the totality of the brain with very little sort of evidentiary sort of experience in hand. Looking at the top of this hand, I'm just going to go through a couple of facts. What we have here is the functional topography of the brain, and where originally the brain worked as what was called a common sensorium, is what it was thought of as. There was no division of labor in the brain, is one way I'd put it. There was no thought that the brain and its different parts had different functions, but rather that it was just this large massive organ that sort of served, or if you look at the bottom, where I have an asterisk on this handout, before the 19th centuries, conclusions about the brain were seen as chaotic and not patterned. The equivalent would be to say that they would look at the brain and its various folds and sort of crumblings and think of it as like the intestines, that there probably is minute sort of physical sort of functions of different parts, but really there's no strategy to the organization of all those folds and masses of flesh, tissue and flesh. There is chaos in how that organ is constructed. The 19th century, based on physiology, is going to be pendulum the other way. There absolutely is organization, down to the point that we can read every bump on your head as a manifestation and an echo or a reflection of that organization of the brain itself. Again, I told you the 19th century is about advancements, but really it's about loyalties. Phrenology suggests a loyalty towards histology and towards anatomy at this particular time, above all else, to the point of where we're actually reading every single fold and bump and nuance in your face and profile as an absolute explanation and indication of what your brain faculties can be and what they might be. To that end, there isn't total bullshit to phrenology. Phrenology did create the idea of brain localization theory, and actually, if you look through the phrenological record, there are times they got it right, quote unquote, where they could understand that certain faculties or certain sort of parts of the brain based on experimentation could have been responsible for memory or speech. Usually those were found out through people they said who had some kind of trauma, head injury to a certain part of the head, lost a faculty in a certain sort of way. They weren't so successful from our side by just feeling the skull, so to speak. But nevertheless, this idea that there could be a localization theory to the brain absolutely has merit to it and absolutely has basis in fact. Having said that, there are also parts to phrenology that we see as an overcompensation of loyalty to a particular discipline. I like phrenology then because it seems to be for us as historians of medicine, the ultimate example of pseudoscience, we're going to talk about in a second, as bullshit science that we're supposed to poo-poo, or it seems like the ultimate kind of science that was a groundbreaker, trailblazer into a whole new discipline that's like the cornerstone of neurology as we understand it today. What neurologist would not be as concerned with the details and minutiae of how the brain works? Phrenology started all that kind of discourse. Having said that, what phrenology provides for me in the 19th century is it is an ultimate scientific lightning rod for what your loyalty is to social causes, to experimental method, to a certain kind of medical practice, and to a certain kind of scientific understanding of medicine. To that end, phrenology, as our interest as historians of medicine, seems to be about what kind of ideas it had. But for me, it is so interesting because it reveals what kind of loyalties people held towards certain forms of science and medicine at the time. Let's look at our first guy here, Franz Joseph Gall. He's the first person to challenge what was called a unitarian, the united view of the brain, and wanted to suggest that there could be a kind of dissection at the level of categorization of parts of the brain. And I'm just going to read what I had listed here. Gall maintained that the brain was a conglomeration of 27 distinct organs, finding physical correlates for the main psychological categories of his time. For example, love of offspring, reproductive offspring, tendency to murder, etc. Animal and human association, other faculties are particular to humans, for example, religion and veneration, covetousness, etc. To that end, the mapping of the brain becomes at once a physiological sort of exercise to sort of map out, demarcate a part of the body, but it also becomes a sociological or psychological sort of exercise to find a correlate between basic human emotions and social interactions towards the brain itself being revelatory of those facts. What's interesting then is that if we take, for example, a cosmological worldview of medicine before Paris medicine, that dealing with the humoral theory, there was an attempt to want to see the body as a mirror in the sense of how the world worked and interacted. And the world in terms of the four elements of earth, wind, air, water, fire, and the natural order of things as God had determined them, so to speak, and the body becoming a mirror of that fact. Well, histology at this time, and phrenology in particular, is about trying to see how the brain itself can actually be the thing that doesn't mirror the world around us, but makes possible the world around us. So if we can look at the brain and determine exactly where the different faculties are and how they interact, that explains why certain personalities or certain people are covetous, or that explains why parentage is prominent in certain people at certain age or certain faculties at certain times. That explains, for example, how the rest of the world works. What's significant then is that phrenologists, if they're valued in many ways, it's because they're some of the earliest notion what we would think of as geneticists of our time. That's just to say that they are persons who absolutely believe that the anatomy of the body, whatever it is, in brain size or whatever, might determine the way that our lives are determined, our skills, our propensities, and the way we interact with one another at the individual level and at the cultural, social sort of level as well. To that end, the body still has a relationship with the rest of the world, as it did centuries prior, but the priority of experience is on the body itself as being a determining sort of agent. Yeah.
Did they ever see phrenology as sort of like determinism and a rejection of like Cartesianism?
Kind of, except for the fact that phrenology, depending on who you ask, whether it was Gall or Spurzheim or the Combe brothers, there was a determinism in the sense that you wanted to sniff out what you could be, or especially if you could be a criminal or a pervert, or if you could be, or on the flip side, you're really creative or what have you. There was an attempt to see that there was something predetermined. On the flip side, though, one of the big advancements of phrenology was the fact that it was supposed to allow us to intervene in these particular possibilities. So on the one hand, if it was deterministic in its rhetoric, it would say, we can help with this particular science to determine who has criminal propensities. But phrenology would go even further, especially under Spurzheim, who basically coined the term phrenology, to say that we can actually curtail some of those tendencies as well, too. So there's at once a deterministic sort of quality and also an attempt to sort of curtail what might be deterministic about the body as well. The hard part about that is that we're going to find phrenology as a discipline was so significant, not just because it had a loyalty towards histology and towards physiology, but it also had a loyalty towards social justice at the same time and social improvement. And to that end, that's where we kind of find the loggerheads, where if it is so beneficial and so valuable as physiologists, as Bernard tells us, to use experimental method, observation, maybe a little logic and maybe a little math, and there we've got it. Phrenologists are basically doing that in their discipline. I'm looking at you, I'm feeling your brain, I'm crunching the numbers, and this is what I came up with. Da-da-da-da, don't say anything, you know, that sort of thing. They're doing their thing. On the other hand, if they're so wedded to that knowledge and the way that it can improve the world around them and how it creates the very temperature of human interactions around them, there's also a tension with that kind of experimental method, and thus also the possibility that that experimental method, as we might say, could be flawed, if you will, to say. some degree. So the a priori, or the even deterministic sort of quality of the knowledge, it varies from person to person, context to context. It even varies from discipline to discipline. So if we're talking about penal reform or criminology, whether we're talking about trying to curtail violence or whether we're trying to improve prison systems, suddenly phrenology is totally deterministic, and the next sentence it's totally ability to change one's own biology to some degree. Let's see here, a couple of things else on here. Gall drew attention to the surface of the brain, especially the gray matter. Until him, the fibrous white portion had received attention mostly in brain studies, or those two anatomies. The significance here also is the fact that we're talking about gall. I have here the term organology. Craniology is the other term that we use attached to gall. It's Spurzheim who coined the phrase phrenology, and that distinction between craniology and phrenology is a significant one, not just in terms of lexicon, but also, again, in terms of loyalty and application. Gall was largely concerned with how to map the mind and how to map it in association with the psychology of the individual. It's almost in the absence of a field of psychiatry at this time that phrenology also provides a language, a lexicon, a categorization for personality, totally somatic in its basis, totally cerebral in its concentration and focus, but a kind of articulation for psychiatric and psychological discourse that just hadn't been made possible at that time. So to that end, Gall's concern is about creating a kind of lexicon and a kind of map of the mind. It's Spurzheim, if you want to turn the page, who is concerned with how to make this into a phrenology, a specific kind of discipline that has correspondence to and a connection to craniology, organology, or organ of the mind, but also wants to find application for that knowledge in a very significant way. Or as it says here, phrenology used both, which is to say both the form of the brain and the shape of the head, so the cranium, and also thinking about what the brain was like underneath, but wanted to use them for popular reasons, so as you see here, personality tests, readings, cultural discussion, and for the study of deviants, the insane, inmates, the perverse, the bad, persons like that. So to that end, what we have then is a particular discipline that is developing from Gall to Spurzheim in its organization, but also developing in the way that it's actually being disseminated, if you will. What's significant to note here, by the way, are that Gall and Spurzheim were touring largely on the continent, giving their particular lectures on phrenology. Gall's probably giving these first lectures in the 1790s, and significantly in the first decade of the 1800s. To that end, there's a kind of currency and a receptivity towards his knowledge as being a new, simply because post-Paris medicine, post-Revolution, French Revolution, we're just kind of anxious to hear new thoughts in general. And I think what happens here is that Gall is both a man of his age in terms of the mindset he has, but he's also a product of his age in that he's very opportunistic in knowing that now is the time to crack with new ideas. He's on lecture tours all over Europe and even up into England and Scotland later. To that end, Spurzheim becomes his assistant in sort of lecturing tour making, and they also sort of disseminate the ideas that they have, but in an attempt to sort of build interest. Now, of course, the thing is, they're building interest on the positive side as much as they are on the negative side for their work, because of the fact that it seems to be an affront to all kinds of beliefs, not just old medicine that's still significant to a lot of people, but also in terms of the ideas of thinking about faith, reason, and the fact that there's a kind of primacy of the brain and its brain, the brain's taxonomy, to a degree that it almost pushes out notions of the soul or values or morals. Yeah, do you hear it?
This sort of mapping reminds me of acupuncture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if there's any awareness of Asian medicine or if it would have been given any currency.
Acupuncture was in discourse and in conversation in Western medicine for many centuries up until then. Having said that, the mapping of it would have been suspicious because of the fact that it seemed to over-prioritize, if you will, anatomy. So that according to Western medicine in about the 17th and 18th centuries, exposure to acupuncture largely was the sense of seeing a mapping of anatomy as overcompensation. So it could have been a more nuanced way of understanding the body. Now, phrenology would have probably found a kindred spirit in some of that kind of acupuncture. I actually haven't read anything where that's the legitimate or the primary motivation for why phrenology is so wedded towards a kind of mapping like you see in acupuncture. But I don't think there would have been the same kind of disrespect for it or distrust of it because of the fact that
it's interesting is that acupuncture is very well respected and phrenology has been completely discredited.
I know what's hard about that too is the fact that what we see is that at the level of how acupuncture is valued and people who are even don't even, if you, we hear this all the time in conversation, right? People who are like, aren't very new agey and don't like have crystals and shit like that, right? Who do acupuncture or whatever, they're like, but it works.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? That's like always the thing they go to, which is to say that the convincingness of acupuncture for a lot of people who may be Western or who may be suspicious of any kind of non-Western medicine is the fact that it's efficacious. You know what I mean? And that seems to be enough. Phrenology is difficult because it wants to provide the mapping without any obvious efficacious sort of delivery. And what it wants to do is provide delivery less at the level of relieving somatic symptoms than of curing social ills. It's really what phrenology wanted to move towards. So that if it's hard to convince people of the effect of acupuncture, if you're not already a fan or an understander of that medicine, the quickest way to convince them is to show them and show that it works or that it can work for you. It seems to be one way. Well, phrenology, because it didn't provide that exact kind of this to this moment of curing a symptom, so to speak, their way was to say, look how it can cure social ills, if you will. So there is a kind of common parallel there. Yeah?
You haven't gotten to this yet, maybe you will, but didn't phrenology also serve as a basis for the racial biases of the time and the gender biases of the time?
It did. We'll get there in a second, in the sense that this is one of those moments where if the experimental method of physiology really wanted to prioritize the fact that we can only know what we experience with our senses and maybe apply a little logic and math and statistics to it, phrenology took that method, but what was informed by it, because of where it wanted to go and what it wanted to deliver, was all of its preconceptions about race, gender, ethnicity, class, structure, so that if it wanted to cure ills, well then what constitutes ills that are social? And therefore the medicine, the understanding of the brain, actually became the thing that didn't determine how those ills were created, but actually by the medicine itself became suspect to those
preconceptions. I think now, because I don't think acupuncture has any such connotation. To my knowledge.
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
But then again, I don't think that acupuncture ever had as its number one modus operandi and number one point of defendability for its existence the fact that it could explain the nature of human interactions and fix the nature of human interactions that weren't working. You know what I mean? Acupuncture seems to be much more focused on individual somatic experiences, yes, seeing commonalities across bodies and seeing that there are certain anatomical correlates between the bottom of one's foot and lower back pain or whatever, you know? But recognizing that how I do this on you can cure your body. Phrenology is to say how I understand the minds of this individual and across minds can actually fix France. You know what I mean? Much larger. Yeah.
Well, I think the other major difference is that I don't think that acupuncture poses as we're science and we're completely rational here, where something like phrenology and they're saying, well, we're completely scientific here, we're going to measure cranial capacity and we're going to put in mustard seeds and tamp them down and prove what we already believe to be the case, which is that, you know, blacks have smaller brains, women have tiny brains, and of course white men have the biggest brains. But we're scientists, so therefore this must be true, and we have proven it.
Well, this is the hard part. We look back and we think that they're just trying to convince themselves of ideas they already have, which they did. But what they were doing was wedded so much to an experimental method and so much to an observational sort of method, that loyalty to science seemed to be possible to curtail any kind of bias that they might be having in their work. If science and the scientific method and the experimental method is supposed to reveal our non-biased understandings of medicine, then to put those methods into practice will just will away and wash away any preconceptions that we have, and we find that that's not the case. The experimental method is a tool towards being non-biased, but it is not the absolute sort of like cure, if you will, for any biases we have. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say that acupuncture, I mean, it's been around since like the second century. Like, this is something that was, you know, the classical treatment from China and from the East, as opposed to like phrenology developing as like a modern theory out of like the new sort of definition of what people were doing with medicine. So I think it's not saying like, oh, well, this is something that this guy came up with here, and this is something that this person came up with here. It's like, you know, a modern theory to them versus like another culture's classical explanation of like a treatment model.
Yeah.
I think that's like...
Well, your word classical is an important one to have here in the sense that phrenology is a product of its time.
Right.
It's a product of its time that it's wedded so much to science and observation and anatomy in a way that shows that, oh, it's very scientific, actually, according to those standards. But it's a product of its time also that it reveals so blaringly to us now in hindsight the biases and prejudices and false expectations of what the scientific method could fix in its own particular way. What phrenology then provided was a kind of mapping and a kind of anatomical prioritization that was significant at the time, but that acupuncture never had to deal with, because acupuncture got to be at once traditional and anatomical. it got to be something that was hand down and learned from experience, and yet also was in contemporary based on practical sort of interactions day to day, trial and error. So what were tensions and what were pitfalls and caveats in Western medicine owing to the legacy of the Western medical tradition? Acupuncture and its various disseminations, treatments, explanations, justifications, and trainings just almost went around those concerns, but because there wasn't the same sort of loyalty or legacy hovering, I think, behind acupuncture that there might have been Western medicine. Yeah.
But I wonder when acupuncture became popularized or widely aware in Western civilization, because I know that when I took a class on military medicine, when the British Empire was actively involved in India, they actually took upon themselves to study folk medicine in India, completely reject them and put in their own clinics and put their own Western idea of of medicine. So, I mean, I see a tradition of Western medicine kind of looking down upon folk medicine from Eastern traditions.
Yeah.
And yet now in the 21st century, we have this sort of mysticism towards Eastern medicine.
We do mystify them. Although your example is interesting about the British military, is that when they're abroad in India or wherever, you know, the long history of Western medicine is, whether it's the French, the German, whatever Western sort of like medicine there is, it's the military abroad, all bets are off. It's all efficacious, whatever works. Surgery, experimentation, folk medicine, whatever the hell you want to call it, you know? Because we're talking about a sense of urgency and a kind of confinement, if you will, and a kind of sort of like out of distance, if you will, from traditional medicine, that innovation often happens in military medicine in ways, whether it's opening up to folk medicine or new kinds of remedies or doing surgical interventions on the battlefield that wouldn't have been possible in the hospital in Paris or what have you. There's that, it's a recurrent sort of theme, if you will. Now, in the 21st century, there is absolutely this strange way in which we sort of mystify, prioritize some of this medicine, but I think that's also an attempt to realize that we see in it, I think, an almost idealized form of harmony between tensions that we have. So if I mention that phrenology seems to be fraught with tensions between old and new, anatomy versus psychology, modern versus anachronistic sort of science, something like acupuncture, in the way that it hasn't had to be fraught with some of those same tensions, just in its history, let's not even talk about its dissemination or how it's put in practice, but just in its history, seems to provide a kind of settling consciousness, I think, for patient goers in a way that so much of Western medicine seems unsettling. After all, Western medicine, the cornerstone about it is the fact that if for so long the continuity of it signified its efficacy, now we don't want outdated, we don't want what our mom had for medicine 25 years ago, we don't want to feel like that there's a standardized thing, we want the newest, we want the cutting edge. And it's in the face of that that we sometimes, I think, reach out to forms of medicine, acupuncture, otherwise, that seem to us to have the ages of wisdom sort of passed through it, in a way that we've sort of exhausted it sometimes, like the practice we have now. Let's look at a couple more facts up here before I direct this towards a few things here. Actually, if you turn to page 223, this is an article by Clark and Chiquina called 19th Century Origins of Neuroscientific Concepts. I just want to direct this towards a couple of passages that provide better phrasing. This is why when you get to the section on phrenology in this, the notes for lecture notes today, I had it very short because I felt like it was best to say in these articles. So on your little handout for the notes for today, next to phrenology, I put down the pages from the Clark and Chiquina article, 223 to 224, and we're going to read these out loud in a second. 236 to 237, and 239 to 240. So just a couple of pages that really provide good encapsulations of what we're talking about here. And I'm just going to read them out loud, unless you have a question, just so we can all hear them together, what we're talking about. This is the bottom of page 223 in the Clark and Chiquina article, 19th Century Origins of Neuroscientific Concepts. Okay, 223. They write, it is of vital importance to differentiate between Gall's organology and Spurzheim's phrenology. In 1812, when the two parted company forever, these two psychophysiological schemes existed. Thereafter, Spurzheim continued to alter Gall's organology, and as noted, he applied the term phrenology to his new scheme in 1818. Whereas Gall remained skeptical of a universal correlation between mental processes and cranial topography, and believed that an acceptable association could be found only in a small number of individuals who proposed particularly well-developed organs, Spurzheim had no such reservations. His phrenology could be successfully applied to all, an attitude reflected in his enthusiastic popularization of phrenology, which he amounted like a social crusade, rather than devoting himself more to the advancement of science, as Gall, on the whole, preferred. Furthermore, although Gall accepted the existence of evil propensities in man, Spurzheim purposely omitted them from his categories because he conceived that man was created potentially good. Eschewing Gall's pessimism, he argued that the human race could be perfected by the aid of phrenology. Looking to the last paragraph on this page, another difference between Gall and Spurzheim was their general approaches to their individual psychophysiological system. To the end, Gall, its creator, maintained his empirical stance, and he came close to what we would call an experimental psychologist, savoring facts, but on the whole, disliking theories. Spurzheim, however, gradually increased his involvement with topics that had nothing to do with brain anatomy and physiology, such as metaphysics and speculation on educational, religious, sociological, and penological issues. In view of these dissimilarities, together with personality and perhaps other differences, it is little wonder that their partnership did not survive. So what we have here is a similar kind of mindset, a similar kind of science, but a very different kind of direction in terms of where each of them want to go. And what those directions signify is not just application, but, as I said before, a difference in loyalty. A loyalty towards experimental method versus toward social application of their mindsets. And which do they think of as more significant? What is the selling point for their science, if you will? Turn to page 236. This one short paragraph on the bottom of page 236. It's a nice distinction between Gall and Spurzheim. Gall's and Spurzheim's systems evoke two basic principles: the doctrine of compound functional localization and a primitive behavioristic and faculty psychology. In retrospect, we judge them to be unlikely bedfellows, for it was a strange association between a scientific hypothesis that had received the unwarranted dignity of being considered a doctrine and a psychological system, which in the case of Spurzheim's version, was a social philosophy disseminating a popular reform movement. In other words, what we had here was a hypothesis of science that was so craved and loved and wanted at that time, given the work of these men over here in physiology, that it went from being a hypothesis to a doctrine in just a couple of years because of how it was marketed, because the market was set for people wanting to hear it. So phrenology got almost institutionalized in a way much faster than it would have any other time because there was a demand for this kind of physiological understanding of psychology or of anatomy. And as well, what happened then was that what could have been a kind of psychological system, a way of understanding human personality and behavior, got immediately transplanted onto a kind of reform movement at the time in a way that it couldn't have any other time. To that end, phrenology is a very interesting kind of science to read in German, French, American, British contexts, because the 19th century is a century of reform that we see happening in each of these countries. Reform of class, reform of gender, it's the birth of the first movements for suffragettes, it's the birth of sort of the creation of civil rights and of racial rights in a way that provides vocabulary that would happen in the 20th century. It's a way of trying to think about sexology and sexuality studies at this time in the 19th century. The 19th century is considered, through Foucault and most social theorists, the birth of discourses, the birth of discussions of race, class, gender, ethnicity. And phrenology came out and provided some of the lexicon for all of that stuff. Thus, it became adored in many circles, not because of the fact that it was as persuasive in its science, but it was longed for in its language. I'll give you an example. If you turn to page, to this phrenology handout I gave you, Phrenology, a Practical Guide by the Fowler Brothers. I provided three examples at the end for you. Those being, on page 75, amativeness with the two heads, right? Big bump in the back, little bump in the back. Mm-hmm. Amativeness is sexuality at that time, desire for the opposite sex. The next one I excised for you was parental love, philoprogenitiveness, I think I said that right? Which is to say, love of offspring, the desire to have children. And the third one I provided to you, I think the word got cut off on page 86, is adhesiveness. Is that word on the top of your page? It's not, I just scribbled it in. Adhesiveness is a love for people of the same gender. Friends, friendship, conviviality, loyalty. That's what it is in a good sense, if you have that in a strong faculty. Adhesiveness, though, in a negative aspect, could also mean queer at the time, too. It could also be a little bit too attached to people of the same gender, if you will. Now, to that end, what it was is a coded way of talking about a kind of desire that really there was no language for. Phrenology is developing in the 18-teens and moving into the 1850s and 60s and 70s. Well, you know the word homosexuality wasn't created until the 1860s or 1870s. So what happens is that phrenology comes about in a way that provides for all kinds of persons, pro and against, same-sex affection, with the very vocabulary and framework to talk about something that didn't have a discussion or a framework for it. And I'm saying that is no exception. There are tons of things in the 19th century that phrenology, its attempt to map the mind, to map the social world, actually provided a kind of discourse and a kind of mapping, if you will, for all kinds of subjects that needed to be talked about. Penal reform, logic, justice, race, ethnicity, and yes, half the time that shit was sexist and racist and bigoted as can be, but nevertheless, provided a kind of discussion about these materials that was longing, that was ready, was primed for in the 19th century. Thus, we look back at it, and we can't think of, we almost look at that, that's why historians of medicine love it so much. We look at phrenology, and it looks like, unlike any other medicine or science, such a product of its time, because it's literally providing discussion and a kind of mouthpiece for cultural and popular understandings through the vehicle of science.
But did it gain so much acceptance because it sounded so, well, I guess because it was perceived to be so medical?
Uh-huh.
Is that what you're saying?
That's part of the reason.
Okay, because I'm thinking like adhesiveness, they wouldn't, you wouldn't call it, you know, you're queer or something, I don't know, like, it just sounds so much, I don't know, even the word just sounds sort of...
technical?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's... And it would have had a lot of reasons it would have had been popular. It was the fact that it seemed to employ physiology. It had an experimental basis behind it at the level of its empirical understanding. It prioritized anatomy in a way that science and medicine were trying to do. It spoke to a lot of social and popular attitudes at the time. It was a great sell into that it seemed to be a panacea or a cure-all for all kinds of problems. If social justice was the name of the game in the 19th century, then this was a period with which phrenology was trying to say, we can help you do that. We can help improve the status of women, or help figure out race relations, or help determine what's the best way to cure criminals, if you will, at a particular time. If this is the era, for example, in the Americas, where we're trying to build prisons that actually reform people, don't just lock them up, as we also see from madhouses, right, in the 19th century, too, phrenology is saying, we can talk about that with you as well, too.
And just like you could say it at a cocktail party and not be...
phrenology?
I sort of think of that, like, adhesiveness sounds so much...
Well, it might not have had that much of a common parlance, you know, unless you actually were conversant in phrenology.
Right.
But I'll give you an example. Like, one of the biggest fans of phrenology in America was Walt Whitman. Mm-hmm. So if you read his poetry, he's got phrenological terms littered throughout it. One of the terms he loves to use the most is adhesiveness. If you don't know, Whitman was as queer as they come. But the thing is that part of the reason he loved it was because of the fact that he could find a way to use a kind of rhetoric that... there was absent in every other venue or forum, so to speak. So there's lots of historical documents that show the kind of readings that, and almost all of them said, like, oh, you're a really good friend, you know, for this particular one. They all did it. So he loved it even more so, you know. But to that end, phrenology is also one of these things that seems to harken back to a different kind of medical marketplace that we have maybe seen before, too, where it's providing for patients sometimes the very kind of affirmations that they want to get in a scientific discourse. Let me direct you towards one more passage in here just to take a look at yourselves. On page 239, it's the last paragraph. On to the next page. According to Gall, the faculties and the organs were capable of growth by means of exercise. On and on. Read that paragraph in the next one. It actually answers your question about the deterministic possibilities of phrenology. From what it's trying to say is that there is potentially something deterministic about phrenology to a point. And to that end, phrenology actually even predates Darwin in the way that it seems to be so deterministic about sort of like social possibilities and biological possibilities. Having said that, as this first half of the sentence shows, through means of exercise and diet and such, one could also affect one's anatomy. So there's a limit to how deterministic that anatomy is. The hard part about phrenology in particular, even more so than cranology or organology of Gall, is that it really wanted to be all answers to all questions and all solutions to all people at a particular time in a way that made it malleable, but also suspicious at the same time. Go back to your handout if you will. I want to walk through just a couple more phrenology facts for you, to give you the long history of what phrenology is. So looking in the middle of the page, by the 1840s, phrenology has pretty much been discredited in most of Western Europe and in the Americas, and largely due to the work here of Pierre Flourens. This is a guy who had been a follower of Gaul, like Spurzheim was, but he eventually, instead of revising Gaul's organology and chronology, decided this is bullshit for him. And so he agreed that the main psychological traits had their seats in the cerebral hemisphere, but felt that the exterior hemispheres, the exteriors of the brain, and therefore the ones that affected the size of the cranium, as a whole unit, were not as significant. And he placed these experiments on birds that he did. In other words, as it says here, the cutting away of layers to see the effects of them. So vivisection was the cornerstone. To that end, a problem he had was that Florenz was interested in Gaul's work because it seemed to be very similar to something like Bichat or Magendie in the way that it had an experimental method to it. His frustration was that it didn't go far enough. So not surprisingly, Spurzheim liked the scientific feel of Gaul's work and took it into the social cultural realm, whereas Florenz liked the scientific practices and took it even more so towards the more Magendie practice and said, well, we got to do our experimentation then. And his animal experimentation led him to believe that phrenology was unconvincing. To that end, he became its biggest critic. Not that he dismantled the discipline entirely. The discipline almost dismantled itself, largely in the way that it became not just a fodder for popular discourse, but also for ridicule sometimes, because it became so wedded to curing so many social ills that it really came across as at once being not scientific enough and a kind of scientific play, if you will, playing at science. There's a history of it very parallel to and similar to the histories of mesmerism, magnetism, hypnosis. These are tools that are still part of medicine sometimes and were very important in the 19th century, but because they developed so much popularity, it was a fine line then between being germane science or vaudeville. You be the judge. That's sort of where phrenology had been falling by the middle of the 19th century. To that end, what we have here then is a kind of way to see phrenology in some ways as having a disreputation, not just on that discipline, but for a couple of decades there on cerebral localization in general. So if phrenology provided the first discourse and first understanding of how to think about the brain as a localized, demarcated organ, if you will, because phrenology gets discredited because of its cultural sort of weights and biases, brain localization theory does as well. Now, we, looking backwards, know that there's great benefits and great truths involved in how brain localization theory works, but we can see how wedded they got to phrenological practice actually made those disreputable as well. But in the 1860s and 70s, we get to this period called New Phrenology. And it's an interesting term because it's called New Phrenology for a while, but the people who are doing it are trying to push away the phrenology and push forward the new, if you know what I mean. To that end, what it's trying to do is try to think about a different kind of evidence for brain localization. So it's not just external anatomy, it's not just evidentiary propensities, so, boy, you are funny, let me check out that part of your brain that means you're funny or what have you, but actually doing a more internal and a more thorough kind of anatomical sort of study. To that end, there's anecdote is less as important than there is on the fact of a kind of method that involves experimentation. Now, it's based on two kinds of things here. These are the two kinds of evidence that form the cornerstone of new phrenology that in some ways could have informed original phrenology, but they weren't its cornerstones. One is clinical observation, so the holdover from Paris medicine, the thing that makes phrenology itself seem like it's a product of its time. But by prioritizing clinical observation, it becomes important in a big way. So in 1861, there's a movement to dissect heads post-mortem, to check out those brains and actually see less what does your sense of humor look like now and how does that make me change the way I feel your head, than how did you live your life and what are the facts I know of your life, and if we did a post-mortem on your brain, how could we see any correlation or not? The biggest person that you want to know in this notion of new phrenology is Pierre Paul Broca. Broca is very famous because he's really the founder of modern physiological studies on aphasia. Aphasia is the study of people who basically lose the faculty of speech. So what Broca was doing, and he's very famous for a patient he worked on by the name of, and let's see here, Tan, is what his pseudonym for him was. This was a figure that he had discovered from, God, I forget where he's from, like the Himalayas or someplace like that. It was somebody who was a medical curiosity at the time because he had all of the faculties of reasoning and logic as a literate person, but could speak a word. So he became this sort of weird, and it wasn't just the fact that his vocal cords were damaged, so it wasn't like he was a mute based on trauma to any kind of vocal cord or sort of throat damage or what have you. To that end, what was then only about this guy? And Broca did lots of studies to determine that there was a portion of his brain that received some kind of trauma, and he therefore isolated where the seat of actual speech could be in the brain. To that end, what he was doing in that very precise anatomical sort of study of an experimental sort of method of clinical observation was harkening back to what phrenology was trying to do, but now doing it in a very different way, based entirely on observation and evidence. He didn't give a shit if Broca was funny or a good friend or wanted to have kids or whatever. That's not where he was interested in what the parts of the brain were. He was concerned with what's evidentiary, with what this man has, Tan, and what does his brain lack and where is there trauma to, and how can I make a correlation between those two. So there is a similarity of phrenology, but a new kind of phrenology that's happening here. The second major cornerstone we see here, and this is where the big difference is that you see, is animal experiments. If animal experimentation, as we saw, was the cornerstone of physiology for Bernard, Méchandy, Cuvier, and sometimes B. Shaw, phrenology, in attempting to be a child of physiology in the first part of the 19th century, did not prioritize animal experimentation enough according to this particular logic. To that end, when new phrenology comes about after the middle of the 19th century, it wants to say we're going to do it right this time. And we're going to do it right this time by prioritizing animal experimentation in a very significant way. As you can see now, the movement is not towards how do we take the knowledge on the brain to improve social ills or social categories or social justice, but rather, how can we just study the brain better? Observation in the clinic, animal experimentation as a correlate for what we need to do. These seem to be the two sort of cornerstones. Now, I mentioned two facts at the bottom, just sort of for fun, for you to notice. There was still a holistic reaction. We've seen a holistic reaction in medicine in the 19th century in general towards histology and different forms of physiology. And that was to want to see the brain as a unified sort of argument, not as I've used the word here, there's sometimes referred to brain localists as being mosaicists. So you know what a mosaic is, like a work of art that has all the little stuff, that want to move away from seeing the brain as a mosaic instead of seeing it as a whole organ. That holistic reaction starts to fall under favor, so that the holistic reaction wants to also say that phrenology still has such a bad name. Even when Broca comes out with his work on Tan, phrenology is still such a tainted name within the 19th century. I think, for me, the notion of brain localization theory as being a debatable fact is sort of put to bed by the First World War. So many people are coming back with head injuries because of the inventions of all these kinds of bombs and shit in that time, that shell shock, the term that gets coined after the First World War, the Great War, really develops this notion of brain trauma in a localized, specific sort of way. And it's after the extensive studies of thousands of men who've come back with shell shock that we actually realize that it is not that brain localization theories are debatable as a field, but how do we best do them? So it really changes in the beginning of the 20th century. The 19th century then becomes this interesting articulation from phrenology to new phrenology to now ultimately shell shock in the beginning of the 20th century of a discipline. And that discipline is brain localization, neurology, wanting to come into fruition. But what's the right category? What's the right loyalty? What's the right language to make it happen? Is where it's a really interesting sort of 19th century, beginning to end sort of history that happens. I want to look really quickly at two things. We've got about 5 minutes, I think. First, I want to just turn you to a couple of passages. This is from the article by Roger Cooter.
Ah,
Cooter. Roger.
Sorry, that's what I thought was.
It's okay. We were thinking it, so it's okay. So, the article, The Cultural Meaning of Popular Science. I just want to direct you towards a couple of passages for you to take a read at. I'm not going to go at them at length talking about this term, this notion of what's the right kind of historiography to do. And what is a Whiggish kind of historiography? Is there maybe what I said from earlier in the term about what Whiggish historiography is?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about Whiggish because I think that was also in some of Foucault's work. You talking about Whigs and Tories?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The term comes from
Whigs, though. Why? And never the Tories?
Well, because the Whig political philosophy is a conservative movement.
Right.
What's that?
I'm sorry, I said because the Tory made it up.
Oh, right.
You're being Whiggish.
We can tell who, the winners choose the sides, right?
Yeah.
But the notion being that if we do a conservative kind of history, a Whiggish kind of history, and a Whiggish political philosophy was one that was very dependent on trying to preserve a lot of the advancements that had been made. Instead of keeping track and keeping count of the injustices we have in society right now, let's keep track of all the advancements and injustices that we've conquered before. Let's preserve. So to that end, it's a movement in politics to want to see change happen slowly. But as a historiographical sort of practice, it's a position that seems to think of yourself being at the apex of human civilization. To want to say, like, weren't things worse before? Look how far we've come. And the hard part is that we don't want to do Whiggish histories in general and need discipline, as I've mentioned to you previously in the semester, but we're so prone to do them in histories of science, medicine, and technology. It's almost a default, and it's hard not to look back at the history of technology or science or medicine 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and not think, things are a lot better now than they ever were in science, medicine, technology. And while we can certainly see that as a common sense sort of assumption, historiographically, it's a dangerous one to make, because we misunderstand what constitutes better on the one hand, but we also then become judges of history rather than real scrutinizers of it. So phrenology is this ultimate example. It looks like, because it's so dubious in so many offensive ways, and truthfully, you should Google phrenology and you'll find all kinds of racist sort of signs. And we'll find in a couple of weeks when we study eugenics, phrenology in many ways, its worst offspring was that it made possible the rhetoric of eugenics in the first part of the 20th century. But even though we can see so many things flawed with the science, with the method, with the technique, even with the damn attitudes that are behind some of it, our job is still not to poo-poo that science. That's why I like to say, and I've said up until now, that I like phrenology because of the fact that it seems to be a pseudoscience, but then it seems to be a trailblazer on the other hand. But for me, it's just like so many other scientific and medical moments that it just reveals a difference in perspective and loyalty. And as flawed as it might seem, or as skewed as it might seem, or as great as it might seem, the fact of the matter is we should study and read phrenology just as we would the history of the microscope, or the history of the polio vaccine, or the history of things that we might otherwise see as great advancements. Phrenology, as medical historians, as historiographers, for us, is just as fruitful and just as revealing, no matter how loaded and how pseudo-scientific it seems. So let me direct you just to a couple passages in here for you to take a look at, basically what this question of pseudoscience is. So pages 16 to 17, it's just the first two or three paragraphs of the section, basically gives you an overview on what Whiggish history is. I've been talking about it all semester, but if you want to hear a good three paragraphs on it, who actually coined the term, take a look at these three. Then I'd have you turn to page 19. This is the paragraph that's in the middle of page 19. Considered from this perspective, those seeking directly, blah, blah, blah. And I'm actually going to read this one out loud so you can get the sense that we're talking about here. It's the biggest reason why Whiggish history, or history of trying to discover what is a pseudoscience, is a bad thing to do. And basically, and I'll say this to you before I read it, Cooter's point is the fact that if we start calling things pseudoscience, we're assuming that we are science. When the truth of the matter is, we may be pseudoscientific, we just don't know it yet. Who's to say 50 years from now we'll look back at our science and feel the same way? And who's not to say that we are so blinded by our own beliefs that we might actually be guilty of the same feeling? So the minute we call somebody else pseudoscientific, we're not realizing that we could be too. So his solution is just get rid of that term pseudoscientific altogether. Unless we're using it in quotes or trying to make some point about it, it's not our job to determine what was scientific and what was pseudoscientific in the past. Rather, our job is to take at face value what was part of the scientific discourse of its time. And phrenology is tough, like eugenics, because we want to look at it and we want to call it pseudoscientific. Not just because it doesn't seem to have a lot of scientific merit to us now, but also because of the sense of we do not want to appear loyal to that kind of sometimes racist, sexist, homophobic sort of science. Here's the paragraph, though, from Cooter. Considered from this perspective, those seeking directly or indirectly to legitimate the value-free wisdom of modern science by drawing upon phrenology as an instance of socially infiltrated knowledge must be seen as engaged in nothing less an ideological campaign. Put another way, those who want to say that we are speaking from a period of modern science and seeing that as pseudoscience, you're not doing history of medicine or history of science. You're doing an ideological campaign to try to make you look better to them, is this point, even if you don't think you're doing it. In forgetting that the science-pseudoscience split was the active creation of intellectuals in a specific socioeconomic context, evaluations of phrenological knowledge, or evaluative deployments of it, only further conceal the subjectively objectified terrain of capitalist social relations. As you will see, this ideological campaign is a part of the same one that in the 19th century was waged by the bourgeois phrenologists themselves when they attempted to separate out a pure version of their science from an ostensibly corrupt version, and when they militantly attacked their opponents in the establishment as mere metaphysicians. In other words, Cooter's point with his whole book on phrenology is that those very categories of science that we attempt to want to call pseudoscience are guilty of that same feeling that we would prefer if we start calling it pseudoscience by trying to determine who's a better or who's a worse form of science. It wasn't their job then, and it's not our job now, and isn't it ironic that we're always drawn to people who are guilty of that same sin? The last part here, if anyone is to be reckoned as acting in the manner of a 19th century phrenologist, therefore, it is not he or she whose work happens or is hoped to be ethically out of fashion, but rather all those who aspire to capitalize on the beleaguered doctrine of skulls by flogging positivist interpretations of it. The last thing I want you to look at in this article is pages 34 to 35. It's just a summation of it at the end. What is the sort of like function of us considering science and medicine and all its glorious and embarrassing sort of moments in the past? Any questions before we close? I encourage you also, by the way, I included a couple of examples from Spurzheim and from Gall in the text, just to read a little bit of the flavor of the kind of efficacy of what phrenology was supposed to provide for people. In fact, if I could end on one last thing, it would be this piece we looked at a second ago, the Phrenology Guide by the Combe Brothers. The Combe and Fowler brothers, by the way, are ironically two of the big proponents of phrenology in the latter part of the 19th century. One is a pair of Scottish brothers and one is a pair of American, I think, brothers. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened to be that they were like selling and marketing that to phrenology. I provide here for you the phrenology head. By this point, the original 27 organs that Gall had provided for us has now been expanded, but this gives you a sense of what the lay of the land looks like. And I'd have you look at on pages 67 through 69, 70, the three basic tenets of what phrenology is supposed to provide, according to the Fowler brothers here. The first is mentioned on page 67. And I like, for example, that they use the term self-classified in the middle of that page, which is to say that phrenologists seem to us to be classifying this mind to meet their own needs on what their own views are on people and personalities. But from this very text, we can see that the mind that is supposed to be revealing for these phrenologists a classification that is developing of its own accord. To that end, the intention is to be empirical, experimental, and in the physiology that's happening here. But as we can see, the application is a little bit different. The second point here on page 68 is to think about the way in which phrenology provides an ideal intertwining of the philosophical and the practical of what medicine and physiology was trying to do at this time. And lastly, on page 70, there's a way in which phrenology teaches what is called here the true philosophy of life. As I mentioned, that adhesiveness provided a discourse for people with same-sex affection at a time when there was no term. As I mentioned, that phrenology provided a full rubric for how to think about penal reform and crime prevention in an era where that was an anomaly and a brand new sort of notion. At a time when phrenology provided the way of thinking about culpability and insanity as not being attached, but actually be somatically wedded in terms of the brain in a particular way. So also phrenology provided a kind of worldview, a philosophy of life that's called here, that provided for many people a kind of reinforcement of beliefs that may have been had and been held. To that end, phrenology becomes the thing that is at once very new and novel as a scientific discipline, but also comforting in the way that it reinforces pre-existing ideas that one may already have. Because as worked out as that template and that map might be of the brain and the mind and the faculties that are attached to it, it's also a template that is pretty much open to also interpretation and application on top of it of one's ideas. As fraught as phrenology's relationship is in the 19th century, it nevertheless has a centuries-long relationship, I think, because it could be so many things to so many people in so many different times and ways. Thanks again, everybody, for coming. Have a great Thanksgiving. I'll see you guys next week. If you happen, by the way, last thing to mention, if you don't have the handouts or if you lose the handouts that I gave out, they'll be online for class.